turning astray of the path that was left long ago. All we leave behind, time after time, is a legacy with nothing to show. Now our country is lost, and it's not without cost, for there's many who struggle every day. And I think that it's time we start crying for our nation and bow our heads and pray. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your...
Hello, everyone. This is Steve Donahue with the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. Today's episode is number 148, and this episode is going to be 10 reasons why I support the Family Integrated Church movement, or reasons why I think that you need to consider becoming a family integrated church or involving yourself in a family integrated church. And I'm just going to walk through these. This has been an area of concern of mine for quite some time. I finally got some thoughts together that make some sense and can be organized in such a way that people can benefit from it. And so I'm going to look at that today. And the first reason, well, before we do that, though, let me just say thank you for all of you who are supporting the show in various ways. And if you do like the show and you want to support the show, there is a tab on the website that you can punch on that will tell you all the ways in which you can support the show. There will also be a link in the show notes, and you can click on either one of those, and that will take you to a site where you will be able to support the show in various ways, monetarily and non-monetarily, and every way. I appreciate your help in that. And so now let's go ahead and listen to the rest of the show, which is going to be the 10 reasons why I agree with, support, encourage you to be a part of, that kind of thing, of the Family Integrated Church movement. Now, just kind of by way of introduction, the Family Integrated Church movement is a recent desire among many, particularly homeschool families, to try to integrate their families in the church itself, rather than to have them segregated up into various groups. What is traditional in most churches today is that when you go to church, your children get put into different groups and sent to children's church and various age-segregated Sunday school classes. They might even separate you, a husband and a wife, and you might go to your various classes. And during the church service, there's a segregation. Young people go to a different place, and then there's Wednesday night youth group and children's ministries and all this kind of stuff. And the family is hardly ever worshiping together, doing Bible study together, learning and growing together, but rather there's this segregation that takes place. And of course, this came about probably as a result of the evolutionary model that we see in the school systems and the segregation that is involved in there. I mean, obviously, after the one-room schoolhouse left, there was a segregation of the ages because the philosophers were highly influenced by the evolutionary model that each child is to progress through certain stages, and that certainly you couldn't have a sixth grader hanging out with a third grader and a sixth grader hanging out with a 12th grader or with parents or something like that. You had to segregate them out so that they could evolve through their necessary paths. And some of it obviously must have been for logistical purposes. Being able to teach to a certain age group is easier than trying to teach to a whole group. And so all of that involved with came into the churches and influenced the churches in a great way. And so now we see today, and you even look at some of the churches that I would consider led by some of the strongest teachers, Alistair Begg and R.C. Sproul and John MacArthur. I mean, there's numerous ones that we could name. All of them pastor churches where there is segregated congregations, segregated based upon age and stage of life, that kind of thing. And as you'll see in a moment, I don't believe that's biblical. I believe that we have a pattern in the scriptures, and there are 10 reasons that I want to outline that encourage us or challenge us to look at that model more closely and to do away with the segregations within the church. So the first reason is it is a pattern in the assumption of Scripture to have the family integrated together in worship. I'm just going to run through a bunch of verses here, and I'm not going to read them all in their entirety. I may summarize some of them, but you should be able to get the idea. You might want to jot them down if you're listening to this, and you can. But Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 and 5. Of course, this is a Shema, hear, O Israel, Lord our God, the Lord is one. You should love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all the soul, with all your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by your way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. I think it's impossible for anyone to be able to fulfill that command if they are sending their kids off to somebody else to be taught the Scriptures. Whether it be a children's minister or a age-segregated Sunday school teacher or something like that, it's impossible to truly walk beside them, to teach them, and to train them if you're not with them. So that's the first one. Exodus chapter 12, verse 21 through 27. It says, "And you shall observe this thing as an ordinance for you and your sons forever." This, of course, is speaking about the Passover. And he's talking about how the Passover is to be celebrated. He says, "So it should be an ordinance for you and your sons forever. And it will come to pass when you come to the land which the Lord your God has given you, just as he has promised, that you shall keep this service. It shall be when your children say to you, 'What do you mean by this?'" Okay, so first of all, the children are to say this. This means that the children are involved in this ceremony, this service with the adults. They weren't segregated out into a separate ceremony that was more age appropriate for them, but rather they were involved in the adult worship and they were included in it. In fact, they were to ask questions. It says, "What do you mean by this service?" Verse 27, "That you shall say, 'It is the Passover sacrifice of the Lord who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt when he struck the Egyptians and delivered our households.' So the people bowed their heads and worshiped." And then Deuteronomy chapter 16, verses 9 through 15, it says, "And you shall count 7 weeks for yourself. Begin to count the seventh week from the time that you begin to put the sickle to the grain. Then you shall keep the Feast of Weeks." So now we're talking about the Feast of Weeks. Earlier it was the Passover. Now we're talking about the Feast of Weeks. "To the Lord your God with the tribute of the free will offering from your hand, which you shall give as the Lord your God blesses you. You shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your son and your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, the Levite who is within your gates, the stranger and the fatherless and the widow who are among you, at the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide. And you shall remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and you shall be careful to observe these statutes. You shall observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days, when you have gathered from the threshing floor and from your winepress, and you shall rejoice in the feast, you, your son, your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, the widow, who are within your gates. 7 days you shall keep the sacred feast to the Lord your God in the place that the Lord your God chooses, because the Lord God will bless you in all that you produce and in the works of your hands, so that you surely rejoice." So here we are celebrating this festival, this Feast of Tabernacles together, and it says all of them were together and celebrating the tabernacle, and they would make booths, and they would live together in these booths as a family, and by doing that, they were to demonstrate this cohesiveness of being out in the wilderness together and being united to that. They weren't segregated out. Children weren't celebrating some other kind of feast while the parents were celebrating one. They were together. And Deuteronomy chapter 31, verses 9 through 13 says, "So Moses wrote this law and delivered it to the priests, the sons of Levi, who bore the ark of the covenant of the Lord, and to all the elders of Israel. And Moses commanded them, saying, 'At the end of every 7 years, at the appointed time, in the year of release, at the Feast of Tabernacles, when all of Israel comes to appear before the Lord your God in the place which he chooses, you shall read this law before all Israel in their hearing. Gather the people together, men and women and little ones, and the strangers within your gates, that they may hear, and that they may learn to fear the Lord your God and carefully observe all the words of this law." Now, it's interesting here that he doesn't separate out the children and say, "Teach it differently to the children." The whole congregation of Israel is gathered together to hear the word of the Lord. And the children, it says, particularly, are among their parents when they hear it. Verse 13 says, "And that their children who have not known it may hear and to learn to fear the Lord your God as long as you live in the land which the Lord your God crosses to possess in Jordan." So the idea is that the way in which the children were to hear the word is when they were with their parents gathered at this sacred assembly to hear the word.
Joshua chapter 8, verses 34 through 35 says, "And afterwards he read all the words of the law." Joshua here is reading from the book of the law to the people of Israel. He says, "The blessings and the cursings according to all that is written in the book of the law." That's Deuteronomy 28 through chapter 30. "There was not a word of all that Moses had commanded, which Joshua did not read before all the assembly of Israel, with the women, the little ones, and the strangers who were living among them." So here Joshua is reading the word to the congregation of Israel. The children, the little ones, it says, were included with the congregation, hearing the word read just as the parents were, just as the adults were. They were not excluded. They were not segregated out to a different congregation of any kind. Ezra chapter 10, verse 1 says, "Now while Ezra was praying and while he was confessing, weeping, and bowing down before the house of God, a very large assembly of men, women, and children gathered to hear him from Israel, for the people wept very bitterly." And we see that he actually read for over 4 hours to the congregation of Israel. And in that reading, he was, of course, gathered with the children of Israel. And they were able to hear, the adults as well as the little ones were able to hear. And then we see in Joel chapter 2, verses 15 and 16, it says, "Blow the trumpet in Zion, consecrate a fast, call a sacred assembly, gather the people, sanctify the congregation, assemble the elders, gather the children and the nursing babes. Let the bridegroom go out from his chamber and the bride from her dressing room." Now, obviously, there is probably some poetic language that is involved here. But nonetheless, I think it's important to indicate that the implication is such that it would be unreasonable for them not to include both the elders and the nursing children, because they would gather together as an assembly. And then Luke chapter 2, verses 42 through 47. So now we're into the New Testament. It says, "And when he was 12 years old," that was Jesus, "they went to Jerusalem according to the custom of the feasts. When they had finished the days, as they returned, the boy Jesus lingered behind at Jerusalem, and Joseph and his mother did not know it, but supposing him to be in the company, they went a day's journey and sought him among the relatives and acquaintances. So when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem seeking him. Now, it was so that after 3 days they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, both listening to them and asking them questions." I think it's interesting here that they were not separated. He was not separated out into a different group, and he was asking the youth group leader or something like that these questions, but he was actually among the elders of the congregation, and he was discussing with the elders. Now we might say, well, this was Jesus. He was different than everybody else. No, this was the custom of the day. This was the normal pattern of the day, that Jewish young men, boys at 12 years of age, would sit among the elders and ask questions. It says in verse 47, "And all who heard him were astonished at his understanding and his answers." So he was obviously a little more advanced in his understanding, as we might expect, of the Son of God when it comes to other children about that age. But nonetheless, the pattern is still there, and that is that he was not segregated out into a different youth group or something like that. Matthew chapter 18, verses 1 through 5 says this, "At that time the disciples came to Jesus, saying, 'Who then is greatest in the kingdom of heaven?' Then Jesus called a little child to him, set him in the midst of them, and said, 'Assuredly I say to you, unless you are converted and become as a little child, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself as a little child is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever receives one child like this in my name receives me.'" And so from that we can gather that Jesus was wanting to include the children in the kingdom of heaven, and to be able to enter into the kingdom of heaven, they were encouraged to be able to take part in the teachings and the training. The other thing is it's interesting to note that this child was listening to Jesus. He or she had to have been among the party that was privy to Jesus' teachings in order for this child to be able to be set upon his lap and to be called to him. So he was not having to call him out of some youth group or something like that, but whether he was there with his parents. Acts chapter 20, verses 7 through 12 says, "Now on the first day of the week, when the disciples came together to break bread, Paul, ready to depart the next day, spoke to them and continued his message until midnight." So he probably started soon after the work day, this would have been on a Sunday, started after the work day, so probably started at 5 or 6 o'clock, and it says he continued through midnight. So this is a long teaching period. This was, up until midnight. Now, the word teaching here was probably, in fact, it was the word dialogismai, which means that it was a dialogue. It was not just his monologue for 6 hours. But nonetheless, the church is gathered together in this upper room, and he is dialoguing with them until midnight. Verse 8, there were many lamps in the upper room where they were gathered together, and in the window there was a certain young man whose name was Eutychus, and who was sinking into a deep sleep. He was overcome by sleep, and as Paul continued speaking, he fell down from the third story and was taken up dead. So it says that, and in the window sat a young certain man named Eutychus, who was sinking into deep sleep. He was overcome by sleep, and as Paul continued speaking, he fell down from the third story and was taken up dead. But Paul went down, fell on him, and embraced him, and said, "Do not trouble yourself, for his life is in him." So he heals this child, and he continues the teaching until daybreak, and this child was with him. Now this child was probably 12 years old or something like that, but nonetheless he was not segregated out into a different group that was hearing a different message, but he was assembled with the rest of the disciples in the upper room, or in this upper room, not the upper room, but in this upper room, listening to Paul. Ephesians chapter 6 says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother," which is the first commandment and the promise. Now, what is interesting about this, of course, comes from the book of Ephesians. And the book of Ephesians was a letter by Paul that was written to the church, and it would have been read by the church in the church. And the fact that he addressed the children in the church indicates that he would have... So the fact that the children were gathered in the congregation that Paul was addressing the letter to indicates that they were not separated out into a different worship service or something like that, but that he was able to address them with the adults who were right after that. Because, of course, right after it says, "And you fathers, do not provoke your children." So the whole assembly, the whole congregation was gathered together, parents, children, and everybody. And then Colossians chapter 3, verse 20, again, similar. It says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord in all things, for this is well-pleasing to the Lord. Fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged." Again, written to a church, to be read in the church, this letter, and it was addressed to both adults and to children at the same time in the same letter. So that's just kind of an overview of the scriptures that indicate the churches met together and did not segregate out based upon age or anything like that. So that's the first reason. The second one is that it prevents passivity in parents, especially fathers. As we looked at already, it is the role of the fathers to train the children in the scriptures. And it is the role of the parents to be able to instruct and to teach them in these things. And they cannot do that if they send their children away. In fact, if they send their children away, or they drop them off, or they, you know, let them go into a children's church or a youth group or some kind of thing like that, then it is allowing them to not take on the responsibilities that they are supposed to as parents in instructing their children. And so they can think, well, I'm not going to teach my children because the youth pastor is doing that, or I'm not going to teach my children because they're in Sunday school class to do that. And so they, it makes them passive in their instruction. But if they are, if they're the ones who are required to step up and to teach, then it makes them more active. And then thirdly, children learn best through example. Some people have said, well, you know, children in a worship service, they're just not going to get it. You know, the message is not designed for, you know, a young child to learn. They got to see pictures and, you know, things like this. And but I beg to differ. I would say that children learn a great deal by watching their parents worship the Lord. What can a child learn by watching his dad worship the Lord, or a daughter watch her mother worship the Lord? With kids, more is caught than is taught. In other words, more is learned through example than what is instructed through dictation. And then number four, it honors parents' authority. A child is not having to decide to listen to a Sunday school teacher or youth group leader or something like that over his parents. We already have enough of this with the school where they're taught something in school and have to come home, and the parents have to kind of re-educate their kids based upon what was taught in school. And of course, another reason for homeschooling. But we shouldn't have that in the church. The parent should be the authority of instructing their children. And when the child has to get maybe divergent views based upon what he's learning from the various teachers at school or at church, then he is having complications with that. And then number five, it adds dynamics to relationship. Older members in the church benefit from having the youthful energy, and young people benefit from having the wisdom of the age and the opportunity to serve them. In other words, if you go to a church where there is segregation of ages and the children go one way and the senior adults go another way and the middle-aged adults go one way, there's rarely this maturing that takes place based upon the ages. And there are so many older people who would benefit from having the energy of the young people running around and seeing the young people learning. And there's a great deal of wisdom that can be passed on a couple of generations down as the grandparents teach the young children what it is to worship the Lord. And that's missed when the when everything is segregated out based upon ages. And then number six is it reflects life. Where in the world do you go to where life is segregated by age? The only place that that is found is actually in the school and school type situations. So churches and things like that. Now, sometimes in sports arenas or sports situations, that's like that. But then, of course, once they leave the programs at school or the programs at the community level and they get into professionals, it's not segregated by age. It's segregated by ability. And in the churches, we must not segregate based upon age because it does not reflect life. Life does not segregate by age. And so when a child grows up and he goes off into the workplace, he's going to be working with adults of various ages. He needs to be able to learn and cooperate and grow and add and serve various age groups. And by segregating them out early in life, it is a real disadvantage to their social development in that way. And then number seven, it causes maturity at all levels. Parents mature by having to step up to the responsibility to disciple their kids and to train them. And so if they're not on par, they need to learn, they need to grow. And by doing that, they are able to grow in maturity. The kids need to step up to adult worship. They need to learn how to sit and they need to learn how to grow. They need to learn how to enjoy adult worship and to worship God at a mature level. And so all levels are able to mature as a result of not segregating them out. And then number eight is it adds unity to the family. In other words, the scriptures teach us that a house divided against itself cannot stand. And when a house goes to church and then they are segregated out based upon ages, the house is divided. And the, you know, junior might want to do one thing because his youth group's doing one thing. And juniorette, who's in the children's ministry, might want to do something else because their children's ministry is doing something else. Mom might want to do one thing. Dad might want to do one thing. And it segregates the family out. Rather, they should be able to go there to worship together and serve one another together and serve the Lord together. And that way it brings a unity to the family. And then number nine, peer groups rarely, if ever, create good things. Again, I want to look at some scripture passages for this. But Proverbs chapter 13, verse 20 says that he who walks with the wise will be wise, but a companion of fools will suffer harm. And when we segregate children up into their own age groups, they end up spending a lot of time with their peers rather than with adults. And a result of that is that they have a pooled foolishness. And a great example of that in the scriptures, or it's really a sad example, but it's a truthful example, is in 2 Kings chapter 2, verse 23. It says, then he went up, this is Elijah, the prophet, went up from there to Bethel. And as he was going up the road, some youths, now the word youths here means somebody from the age of 12 to 18. This is the perfect youth group age, right? Someone from the youth group, several of them, came up from the city and mocked him and said to him, go up, you bald head, go up, you bald head. Now, this expression was not criticizing his lack of hair, although he probably lacked hair. It was more a criticism of his nature, unlike that of his predecessor, who was more hairy than he is. And so they were probably basically saying, you go and join the other prophet, you're no use around here. Verse 24, so he turned around and looked at them and pronounced a curse on them in the name of the Lord. And two female bears came out of the woods and mauled 42 of the youths. So this was a big group, 42 of the youths. Now, I think it's interesting that there were no parents involved here. If there were parents or grandparents there, certainly they wouldn't have had this group mocking the prophet of God. But it was because there was a pool of foolishness, a pure group, if you will, of people who were teenagers, that they involved themselves in this mocking of Elijah. And as a result, Elijah called upon God, and God sent these bears, two bears, to maul the youth. Verse 25, then he went from there to Mount Carmel, and from there he turned to Samaria. And then we look at the discipleship ministry of Jesus and his principles. And in Mark chapter 3, verse 14, it says, then he appointed 12 that they might be with him, and he might send them out to preach. In other words, the ministry that he had with his disciples, the way in which he discipled them, was that he was with them. He spent time with them. And that's really the only way in which discipleship can take place, is when they have time together and they're able to instruct in that way. Acts chapter 4, verse 13 then continues when it says, "Now when they saw the boldness of Peter and John, and perceived that they were uneducated, untrained men." This doesn't mean that they didn't know how to read and write. It meant that they had never been to a formal synagogue school, that they had never really studied under any of the known scholars of the day. It says, "And perceived that they were uneducated, untrained men, they marveled, and they realized that they had been with Jesus." And so the ministry that Jesus had with these 12 disciples was sufficient enough. Just by being with them and teaching them and having them walk alongside him, he was able to disciple them to the point where they were amazed at how well educated these 12 were. And so we should look at that as a model for us as well. And then finally, but not least, number 10, statistics demonstrate that segregation doesn't work. If you look at the statistics of the rate at which young people fall away from the faith in traditional churches that have segregated ministries, they've done a poor job. Now, one would argue that, well, maybe this is not a result of the segregated ministries. Maybe it's a result of something else. And perhaps it is. We can't isolate just that. But nonetheless, it's not working. Over 70% of churched young people leave the church after high school. That is a failure rate by anyone's classification. That means only 30% stay within the church. And when their age group-specific program seems to end, their involvement in the church ends. And so they're not involved in the church. They're involved in a certain age-segregated part of that church. And the more that we can involve them in the entirety of the church, without segregating them out, but involving them in the entirety, it's an easy transition. They don't go anywhere else when they turn to a new age. They just continue to stay in the same place, worshiping the Lord in the same way that they have been worshiping since day one they started in the church. And that's the model that we have in the scriptures. So hopefully that's been an encouragement to you. You've been able to see 10 reasons why family integrated church movement is the direction that the churches should be going, the direction that I am going. And maybe that has encouraged you to take steps towards doing that in your own church. I would encourage you that if you're in a traditional church where there's all kinds of segregated ministries, that maybe the first step for you, not necessarily to leave the church, but maybe the first step for you is to keep your kids in worship service with you rather than to segregate them out into children's ministries and youth group ministries and things like that, and have them start worshiping with you. Now, if you get a lot of resistance with that, which you probably will because there is a vetted interest that some of the various pastors have in the church to be able to support their own ministries. And if you're not supporting them, then of course they're looking at that in a negative way. And so there's a vested interest in that. But if there's some difficulty, if they're starting to cause some difficulty for you, then you may need to look at a new church. But for now, why not just trying to involve yourself together as a family unit, worshiping the Lord, studying the Bible together rather than segregate it out. And that's maybe the first step. If you have questions, feel free to make some comments in the comments section of the website or email me at steve@thelegacypodcast.com. I'd be glad to share with you any more thoughts or questions or give you some more resources in that way. But hopefully this has been helpful for you. And with that, this has been Steve Donahue with the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. What will you do today to build your legacy?
I think that it's time we start crying for our nation and bow our heads and pray. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? But just like the plant that withers away, we will leave many seeds behind. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? What will you do to change your legacy?